The Don't Shoot the Messenger podcast is proudly supported by Red Energy, powered by Snowy Hydro, a leader in renewable energy. Switch to Aussie-owned Red Energy today. Prince Wine Store, bringing Melburnians the greatest wine in the world. And Cobram Estate, Australia's most awarded extra virgin olive oil, grown, harvested and first cold pressed in northern Victoria.
Don't Shoot the Messenger podcast with Caroline Wilson and Corey Perkin.
Yes, and welcome to episode 289 of Don't Shoot the Messenger. I'm Caroline Wilson. I'm here with Corey Perkin, my friend and fellow podcaster. Do we have a bumper podcast for you today? We're going to kick off, Corey, by thanking Red Energy, one of our major sponsor, 100% Australian electricity and gas. And Corey, we're going to kick off with some homework following our conversation last week about grandparenting. How's little Jack going? Week two?
Jack is great. Hi, everybody. And thank you to all of the podcast gang who left such lovely messages and lots of likes on the Don't Shoot Pod Instagram account, Caro.
Baby Jack. The glamorous grandmother photograph just went off.
A lot of comments about he has my hair, which is probably, he probably does, except mine is naturally grey and his is naturally silver. But
he has father's hair.
He is a beautiful baby and everything's going very well. And I'm spending a couple of days there this week and that's fun. And we're having a great time with him and Lib and Will are doing so well. So thanks everybody for your interest. Caro, Catherine left us a message saying, she says,
stop.
Please call me Kat.
Yeah, stop. No, she wants to be Kat. I think there's a reason it's an anonymous thing.
Oh, okay, sorry. Caro, we have a lovely message from Kat, re-grandparents and caring for them and so on. And she says, one day a week for 10 years and another 2 years to go. I wouldn't have had it any other way. Pre-retirement, I worked 3 days. So easy to make one other day for grandies. A Monday, and then I have any public holiday free. The other stipulation was we'd give parents a few weeks' notice with holiday dates, grocery shopping, cafe visits, playgrounds, and Corrie an hour or so at Fun Bugs in Ballarat is very enjoyable now and then.
Have you been to Fun Bugs?
I have been to something like that. I don't know what it was called. It's lots of bouncy, rubbery stuff that the kids bounce around on. Maybe it's the same thing. And Kat continues, for the grandies at school age, a sleepover during term break is also another way to stay in touch with them without parents around. P.S., says Kat, I came across Don't Shoot in March 2023, listening each week, but also then at least 3 episodes from the start. I'm up to June 2020.
Oh.
Caro, she's back in lockdown with us.
It was a long and, well, it wasn't a grim period, really. It was actually quite good. Did we do them all remotely, didn't we?
There were some that we did socially distancing at your house or mine. I remember being in the garden at your Melbourne home. We were keeping our distance and Miss Jane was recording us from the other side of the living room. But, that's lovely to hear, Kat. Well, welcome to the Don't Shoot the Messenger gang. We are a pretty lovely bunch. And how are things in your world, Caro?
Oh, it's been a post-footy season. Well, there's massive football stories continuing. And I wrote last week about the Hawthorn business, but the Melbourne situation is continuing to implode. And on SEN this week, Simon Goodwin, the Melbourne coach, and Gary Pird have come in and done a big exclusive with The Breakfast Show and, you know, basically hinted at some serious issues going on with Clayton Oliver, which we've known about now for some time. But probably more serious than people had actually realised, and there was only so much they could say. Simon Goodwin addressing the ongoing speculation about his private life and his issues and saying it's just not true and it's starting to have an effect on his family. So football's been big. The races have got going. A lot of comparisons between Melbourne and Sydney, which is not surprising. A few lovely parties, some beautiful Melbourne days.
You went to a concert, didn't you, the other night?
Yeah, Melbourne on Sunday. The Botanic Gardens, they were just, it was like my daughter's wonderful in-laws from Sydney were visiting, and they said it was like Vondelpark at the height of summer in Amsterdam. They couldn't believe how beautiful it was. They couldn't believe the children's garden, the renovated, what was the kiosk, which is now that fabulous cafe down on the lake.
Local brown bar somewhere?
Yeah, no brown bars. Auckland Street, St Kilda was the same where we were on Sunday. Absolutely chock-a-block. Canteen, the beautiful cafe down on the Yarra in South Yarra. It was just the most perfect day. So now Melbourne is rocketing. The peninsula is rocketing. The countryside is rocketing. It's a good time to be around. But there was also some really sad news over the weekend. And this is a sort of an international story, and it's a celebrity story. And none of us really knew him, but you and I were friends aficionados. Matthew Perry died at the age of 54. Incredibly sad. Obviously someone who has battled not only with stardom and the price of stardom, but addiction. A lot of pain medication, I noticed, and prescription medication was found in the house after the Ambos and everyone else arrived. But it took us all back to friends, didn't it? And what an extraordinary show that was.
Yeah, it did, Caro. It's really interesting. Friends, of course, everybody knows the facts and figures about Friends. It premiered in 1994. It ran for 10 years. At its peak, 20 to 30 million viewers a week were watching it in the US. And it was the sitcom about six friends living in New York, Rachel, Joey, Monica, Phoebe, and Chandler and Ross. And Matthew Perry played the character of Chandler, who often had the drop-dead hilarious lines, slightly insecure character, utterly reliable, and always there for everybody. But he played it so beautifully, Matthew Perry. And, of course, to people my children's age, we were talking about this last night with Will and Lib, that Friends went on at our house after bath time. And even though my kids, well, the older two were kind of age 10, age 8, that sort of thing, they really connected in with it. And of course, it was funny and it was safe, so I didn't mind them watching it. And I think it taught them a lot about the joys of friendship, people, you know, the situation. Like, so if you call it a situation comedy, often with these things, the emphasis is on comedy, like Seinfeld. But it's the situations of Friends, I think, that created the interesting watching factor there, the dilemma that they would go through, the love affairs, the moral, or just all those moral dilemmas that they seem to deal with.
And the work dramas, the coffee shop dramas. Courtney Jane has something to add here.
I think for me, we grew up with it every Monday night in our household, and the innocence of the show as well, because my brother and I loved it, watching it, and we didn't understand probably the reference to some of the relationships, but Mum and Dad would sit there and have a good old laugh. We'd laugh at some of Joey's jokes or Chandler's jokes.
I think that's right, isn't it? It appealed to all generations. It's a bit like Bluey. We can now all watch Bluey and we laugh hysterically because there are two different levels of comedy there. And you're right, it was innocent. And it was just, anyway, it just seemed to be on our house for 10 years.
It was so funny. It was so funny. And the characters were all incredibly likable in their own way.
Great actors, too.
Jennifer Aniston obviously went on to become the biggest star, I guess, by far the biggest star. The cameos as the series went on of all the parents, remember Elliot Gould, was just hysterical.
Bruce Willis rocked up.
But they could never,
there's
no way they could have afforded those apartments in New York on the jobs they had. I mean, that was just so unrealistic. But it worked. And Courtney Cox was absolutely brilliant as Monica. No, look, there was something about that group of people that just worked. I remember, what year did you say it started, Corrie?
1994.
Yeah, so I remember it was heavily promoted by the 7 network. Was it on Channel 7? I think so, yeah. Heavily promoted by Channel 7 during Olympic campaigns. The last episode of Friends, how we all waited and waited for that. I mean, there were The relationships. Remember Ross? But we were on a break. No, Ross. You were unfaithful. Right. The wedding episodes.
Yeah.
I agree, though, Reid Chandler. I think there was, and I loved Phoebe as well, but she was, and she went on to be a very successful movie
Lisa
actor.
Lisa Kudrow, yeah.
But he was, there was something about him. He yeah. was so imperfectly perfect.
Yeah, he was. He was. And he had a very strong moral compass, despite the often confusion. He seemed to be the most insecure of the group, but he was in so many ways the wisest, actually. And his relationship with Joey, you know, just that scene when he decides, Chandler decides to move in with Monica and Joey's left, well, what about me? I mean, there were just so many wonderful episodes that touched your heart. And I think, as I said, it was the situation that drew us in, and it was the comedy that kept us there, and the brilliant acting as well. And Matthew Perry was a huge part of that.
The song was
yeah,
so brilliant.
And you know, it was really, for me, it was a time frame in my life, the mother of young children, knowing that I could put them in front of the television to watch a show that was all about friendship and a bit of fun, and we could all watch it on different levels, watch it together, as Courtney said, was so important. But, Cara, there have been over the many years that you and I have been, you and I were pretty much born at the time that television really came to Australia and in a big way. And of course, now we're here in the 2020s and streaming services seem to be taking over our lives and our really dictating our viewing patterns now. And so maybe the old, why doesn't the family all sit down together at 7:30 and watch a situation comedy together? Maybe those days are gone. But I can remember so many transforming television programs, even going back to when I was too young for this, but I Love Lucy. First episode of that was made in 1951. It came out to Australia a few years later when we had television. But I remember my mum and dad watching that, and it was about Ricky Ricardo and Lucy, and eventually, you know, as the years went on, they had their baby and they had another baby, and it was their domestic life. And that's what our parents were going through. So for them, it was very directional, inspiring. I don't know whether you want to be as crazy as Lucille Ball, but it was just, they loved it because it talked to their lives. My brother, I remember, was obsessed as a kid in the 60s, Texas Rangers, Gunsmoke, Bonanza. So all of that, this is now inappropriate to say this, but all that Cowboys and Indian stuff that he used to play in the back garden and little boys growing up. Then we all went on to the Cold War with the man from UNCLA, the Avengers, Mission Impossible.
Lucy was another great example of what we've been talking about in recent weeks. When Lucy's marriage broke up and Lucy was just on her own, she held the show. I mean, she was the star of the show, and her kids grew up. Lucy Arnaz and Desi Arnaz Jr., they became part of the show, but it didn't matter that he was...
Desi was off with the showgirl, yep.
She was the absolute... And it's all about family dynamics, and Friends was, even though... Well, they were sort of a family, weren't they, in their own right? And their crazy family members would turn up once in a while, like Seinfeld.
Mm.
They were a bizarre sort of dysfunctional family too in their own way. There was so... Remember Mad About You? I mean, that was a great story, a more modern one, about a couple and Helen Hunt.
Helen Hunt and Paul... name's gone out of my head, yeah.
Yeah, went on to become, you know, she went on to become a successful movie
actor.
But
Brady Bunch, Cara. So the Brady Bunch, the premise is that Carol Brady and Mike Brady are both, they're not divorcees, they're widowed and widower, but you could have thrown in a couple of divorcees there. And they get together and they each have three children. And the dynamic there, so that created for us as kids in the early 70s, taught me a lot about blended families. Now, it all did seem to be happy and rosy, and they, in fact, did have a maid called Alice, which a lot of blended families don't have, that opportunity.
And it was one of the first times, I think, a couple was allowed to lie in bed together, in a double bed together, and actually have conversations.
But you and I have talked about also the impact on our lives of, and I was telling the kids this last night, the Mary Tyler Moore Show. So there for us in the early 70s was a woman who was single, financially in control of her own life, professionally in charge of a newsroom. She was a newsroom producer.
She had the men listen to her. So that was really the first time that we saw women being authoritative, even though sometimes that created its own situation comedy with tensions. But Ed Asner, who played Lou Grant, her boss, was always deferring to Mary. And we saw a woman in power of her own destiny, a working woman, just like, remember, we've talked about it before, that girl with Marlo Thomas.
Yep, another great opening song. But and all the spin-offs, Rhoda, the Cloris Leachman character, she got her own spin-off.
Phyllis.
Lou Grant got his own spin-off. There were so many. I think I probably loved, the workplace and the family dynamics ones were the ones. Lost in Space. I mean, I know they're in space, but it was all about the family dynamics. And the bad egg, Dr. Smith and the crazy, the weird sort of robot idea.
And we're forgetting, of course, the big one of our time. Well, Absolutely Fabulous was pretty dynamic too out of the UK, but Sex and the City.
Yep. Well, that was sort of another dysfunctional family of four great friends and their family members and their partners. They were important, but it was the four gals.
It was. But,
really.
But think about the impact of the fashion, the talk. The lines that came out of Sex and the City. And kids like my daughter who I discovered on the sofa with my, because I was a television reviewer then for The Age. And the tapes had been sent out from Channel 9 with four episodes of this hot new show. And one of the episodes for us to have a look at was Charlotte saying, "I'm not an up the butt girl."
Oh.
And there was my 12, 13-year-old daughter and her friend sitting watching that episode. Hopefully went over their heads. But as Francesca would say, they lived and breathed that for their kind of 10 or 15 years and have gone back to it every time there's a Sex and the City movie.
Yeah, no, well, yes. And I used to watch it with my very young son Ned when I was feeding Clementine, who was a newborn baby, and I don't think he really understood, but it was sort of a nice cosy spot on the sofa to be. My all-time favourite dating back to the 60s, if I had to name one, was Patty Duke, the Patty Duke show. I just love that
family
show.
Family dynamics.
Loved it with the sort of upright, sort of well-behaved twin from England. It was such a great idea. It was a great idea.
Kathy from England. No, Patty. Kathy from England.
Kathy from England and Patty who's been most. Kathy who's been
most everywhere.
From Zanzibar to
Berkeley Square.
And they lived in Brooklyn Heights. That was, looking back, it must be so dated now. That was a brilliant show. And I found it really funny. I mean, it wasn't our, I suppose as Australians, we had the Sullivans. I mean, that was probably the most, I remember when that came out, that had a huge impact on all of us. And sadly, when the war ended, it just sort of didn't really work anymore.
No, and that's like Bell Bird too. Once Charlie Cousins fell off the wheat silo to his death, that was the end for me.
The modern one now in streaming years is probably that had the biggest effect on us, and we watched it till the day it ended, was Derry Girls. Mm. That was that's a great family comedy, really, but black comedy set in Derry in Ireland. And, there's a gritty sort of black humour there, but gee, that family is the blended family of all time. Just the father who hates his son-in-law and treats him so badly.
And it's interesting, isn't it, that my mother for years watched Coronation Street, and I can't remember, somebody will let us know, but somebody famous, one of the actors, the really famous characters, died. No idea who it was, but it was sometime in the late 60s or 70s. And I remember my mother being so affected that this actor had died, and more concerned, I think, about what would happen with the script and how are they going to. But isn't it interesting how those characters, like Chandler, played by Matthew Perry, that those people can't become such a part of our lives?
He just sort of, I remember he was given a, he got a big gig. I think he was hosting, it wasn't the Oscars, I think he hosted the Emmys one year. And he just, it didn't ring true. Once he wasn't Chandler anymore, he never really worked in any other. And that happened to a lot of performers. As a host, he over-egged it. He was a bit fawning. He cracked jokes that, for me, didn't quite work. Whereas Chandler was just the perfect character. Chandler in the workplace, as the love interest for Monica, as the, the man, the bromance with Joey. I don't know. It just sort of works so brilliantly.
Well, then that gets back to writers, doesn't it?
It does. No, it was. It's funny that that show was one of the last great American sitcoms.
What about,
I guess.
What about movies that have really defined a generation?
Oh, gee, you've questioned without notice.
I know. Well, I was just thinking about this last night. The Breakfast Club was a bit too young for me, but nonetheless, all of those stars who made our kids
watch The Breakfast Club a few years ago at Christmas one year.
And all those young actors who then became stars in their own right, like Rob Lowe and Demi Moore and so on, that was a defining moment. The one that we still play at our house at holiday time when we're all together, but the kids adored it. And in fact, I had T-shirts made saying, "Save Ferris." I think it was about their sixth Christmas.
That still works.
Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Just huge in our family. Huge.
And that still works. But I remember when we all had COVID in Amsterdam, Rose made us watch Titanic. I said, "I'm not watching Titanic again." And, you know, it stands up. It stands up. It really does. And I made her and Oscar watch Working Girl, one of my favourite films.
With Melanie Griffith.
Yeah, it doesn't really...
Doesn't it?
No. She was just a bit sort of cynical about it all.
You remember when I was on the plane and I watched that, and anybody can access it through streaming services, the wonderful documentary on Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward.
Yep.
And there are lots of scenes from Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, which was, even though I saw it when I think I was probably 9 or 10, it just remained one of my great favourite 70s movies.
Me too, yeah.
I felt watching those clips again from that film, it hadn't dated. It's still a really good dark comedy. Cowboy.
That's right.
1800s movie.
I think that one definitely worked. I think a lot of the Julia Roberts films, you go back to the Mystic Pizza, which was her first sort of breakout role. I suppose her real breakout role was the one with Richard Gere.
Pretty Girl. Pretty Woman.
Pretty Woman, which, again, pretty dated.
It is a bit dated.
I mean, you know, when you look at the premise of the story.
It is a bit dated.
And yet she was absolutely fantastic in it, you know, and it was just a film that everybody. And then all the ones by the working title people and Richard Curtis. I mean, Notting Hill.
Yeah.
Notting Hill just still works.
Kramer versus Kramer. That was one of the first deep dives into the impact of separated divorced parents on children and families.
Yeah, and that actually still works.
That still resonates.
I've watched that again. The Woody Allen films, while they're dated, they still really resonate with me,
You know,
particularly Manhattan.
You know what's really dated? Oh, Saturday Night Fever.
Oh, well, not surprised.
Saturday Night Fever has not aged well, although the music's still great, but...
It was never the most incredible story. It was always about the music, really, wasn't it?
It was about the dancing. Clueless is still pretty good with Alicia Silverstone.
Well, that's Jane Austen.
Yeah, that's Jane Austen. Yeah, there you go.
No wonder. Hey, Corrie, this is fascinating going down memory lane, but I think we need a drink now.
Search princewinestore.com.au, bringing Melburnians the greatest wine in the world.
Thompson Corrie joins us this week to talk about one of my favourite subjects. I'm not sure whether it's one of yours.
It's not one of mine, but look, I'm prepared to go on the journey, especially as Miles has come in today bearing gifts.
Miles Thompson, welcome. We're talking rosé, but Miles has brought in a beautiful bottle of rosé for Corrie, and I've scored the Canonita, which we talked about last week.
Yeah.
Which was a really lovely aperitif.
Yeah, it's kind of like a Aperol alternative.
And we're mixing it with water again. Remind everybody.
I just treat it like an Aperol, so soda and
Prosecco and soda,
Prosecco or something. And I always said add a dash of like red Spanish vermouth or something just for funsies.
And the top of the bottle is shaped like an orange. There's an orange on the cover and it says it's of Mallorca, which makes me very happy, Corrie. But Miles, rosés. Now, first of all, tell us, it's a great time to drink rosé. Sunday was a good rosé day.
And yesterday was beautiful too.
Yeah. Corrie's holding a lovely bottle there. So what is it?
Yeah, so this is, I've got a really great value one and I've got a more premium. This is the more premium you've got in your hand, Chateau de Rouet rosé, and it's a proper Provence rosé, and that bottle shape is actually fairly traditional Provence. You actually see a lot of them don't do it, but that is typically what you used to see. So are doing it now. I think there was this idea that it was a bit naff, that shape, and then now it's sort of back in trend.
So we're going to describe the shape.
Yeah.
If you can imagine an hourglass figure
absolutely.
Of a woman.
Correct.
Except imagine there's a lot more of the upper body than the lower body is how I'd probably suggest
true.
It.
It's absolutely beautiful.
Isn't
it's a
it
beautiful
gorgeous?
Bottle.
It's yeah. really, it's evocative. It's just, it's very beautiful.
What is it called?
So Chateau de Rouet.
Mm-hmm. 2022, it says here.
There are about five generations in there. They have this really incredible property that they're on. A bit more sort of volcanic soils in Provence there. And they back up to the Rouet, which is, I think, the actual, an old dormant volcano or, you know, it's not active anymore.
Yep.
Volcano. So, and they have the soils of these volcanic soils through there as well. So that it's definitely, we sort of talk about there's Bandol to the sort of west there, which tends to be a really sort of quite a rich sort of style rosé. And this sort of skirts the middle ground. So a little bit more delicate than you see from Bandol, but a little bit more than you see from Bandol, but still has a bit more sort of richness. So lovely, you know, like sort of beautiful kind of grapefruit and pink grapefruit, lovely sort of, you know, strawberries and those kind of cranberry sort of thing going on. Lovely mineral sort of quartzy thing to it. And this lovely, really lovely sort of spicy sort of nose on it that you often see out of Provence because it's got quite a bit of a grape called Cinsault in it, about 30%. The rest is Grenache. So you think all those varietals have these lovely sort of lifted, pretty sort of small berry sort of floral things in this kind of lovely sort of spicy element, which I think is so fantastic in Provence rosé. Lovely sort of plush fruits, the lovely sort of citrus elements that come through as well.
The colour is beautiful. I would
that really
I would describe that if people have any rose gold in their jewellery box. This is the colour of rose gold. It's just gorgeous.
And, of course, with rosé, it's become all about the colour, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Because in the early days they were darker and there's still some darker rosés that
still
put
is.
People off.
Yeah, I think so.
Wrongly, I think.
You've got to be careful with colour in wine because it doesn't necessarily indicate what it's going to look like, although often the darker coloured rosés tend to be a bit, I guess, fruitier, sometimes even maybe a touch off dry.
Yep.
But you see a lot of rosé out of it. Italy can be quite dark, but it's often still quite sort of textural. And these are quite textural sort of rosés as well. So, yeah, and definitely everyone, you know, everyone in a lot of producers in Australia are aiming for that sort of pale salmon sort of colour that you get with Provence rosé, which is what you can sort of see in the bottle here.
How much is this one?
So that's $45 a bottle. So that's kind of on the premium side. But it's a pretty serious rosé.
It looks
they essentially just make the one, as
beautiful.
My understanding. So all the sort of best stuff goes into that one. So.
And for the more affordable everyday bottle, where are we travelling to for that?
So it's still in Provence, but it's Jules Mediterranean Rosé. Now, they call it Mediterranean Rosé because they do source some of their fruit from outside of the Provence sort of appellation. So they can't call it Provence Rosé. But it is really pretty similar. It's $20 a bottle. It's actually imported by an old employee of ours, Felix, and he sort of started off specialty importing rosés in particular, and this was one of his first. And we have had the Jules floor stacked in our store, I think, basically since he started bringing it in. It has to be one of the best value French rosés around. It is absolutely fantastic.
Jules as in J-E-W-E?
J-U-L-E-S.
Oh, okay, sorry.
As in Julian Jules.
As in Jules Verne.
$20.
$20 a bottle.
Yeah, it's cracking. That lovely pale sort of, that lovely kind of citrus peel and kind of cranberry juice sort of thing. Nice and fresh, really like fruity, easy drinking, but still nice and dry and zingy as well. It's a really cracking little wine for the money.
And not that we should be judging a book by its cover, but what shape is the bottle?
It's quite a plain shape.
Is it? Not as pretty as this
your
other one in front of me.
That is the one. Yep.
Chateau de Rouet is my
a lovely,
beautiful bottle in front of me. That's a standard bottle. Courtney Jane's
and
holding
it's
up on
also,
but it's
also
really
a lovely
Google.
Pale salmon colour.
But it's
not Google, sorry, princewinestore.com.au.
If you like Provence rosé, you're going to like it. It's essentially, I think it's something like 70 or 80% of it's basically made in Provence. They just source enough fruit outside that they can't legally call it Provence rosé.
What would be the most favourite meal that you would pair with one of these rosés? Let's take mine. Let's take the Chateau de Rouet.
Well, definitely seafood for me.
Yeah, I always
think. What kind of seafood, though? Seafood can often require different.
I love rosé with a. I make a mean seafood stew, which is a really nice recipe.
Yeah,
I think I've done on the podcast before. It involves salmon, prawns, and mussels, and an orange rind, and bay leaf, and a tomatoey sort of base.
Sounds a bit like a bouillabaisse.
Yeah, but it's...
Or Chiapino, yeah. The Italian, that's... Have you had Chiapino before?
No, but that's...
It's like an Italian fish soup, and it's a kind of tomato, but not thick. Yeah. It's beautiful. It's really beautiful.
I reckon rosé is great.
So you go rich flavours.
I think rosé is, in general, a fantastic food wine. That's been my thing for a long time. It is really versatile, and it's got enough kind of guts.
Pretty good without food as well.
Often quite textural. Yeah, and that's the thing. And then it's so great without food as well. So I think it's really sort of versatile as far as what you can do. But I think like a nice piece of poached salmon would be perfect. You know, like poached chicken and like, I think like provincial herbs, you know, some sort of, you know, poached chicken with herbs, maybe even a really sort of light cream sauce would be really lovely as well.
I remember early days living in London, coming home to our flat in Earl's Court, and my friend Virginia Corrie, we would have been in our early 20s, mid-20s, sitting on our tiny little veranda playing jazz. It was a beautiful sunny afternoon. I'd come home from work. She was sitting on this little veranda drinking a glass of Rosé d'Anjou. And I thought, yep,
nice.
Yeah, life's pretty good.
Yeah.
And it was
a long,
and Mum started drinking it in those wine, beautiful old-fashioned shaped wine glasses in the 70s. It was a drink that they all sort of started to enjoy. But there's something about a chilled rosé on a warm afternoon.
Absolutely.
Oh, it's just absolutely perfect.
So good. I'm a huge rosé fan. I know a lot of people kind of are a bit whatever about it, but... Whatever. We love it. We have a huge rosé event in sort of late November too. So
yeah, we have to remember
30,
that
40,
one.
Yeah, November 23rd.
And how can people book in? Do they have to book in or can they just
Yeah, you
up?
Have to book in. We get sausages from gamekeepers, fry them up on the barbecue, rosé and sausages. We've been running it almost as long as we've been running the champagne event. So it's kind of one of our big events for the year.
Just a little off the rosé topic, can I just thank you, Miles, or it might have been Gab, actually, who recommended the André Clouet champagne to me a few months ago. My husband and I, as the Queen would say, celebrated little Jack's birthday arrival on Friday or Saturday night. I can't remember which. We opened a bottle of that, and it is to die for, Caro. That is
very, very good.
At the moment, my favourite champagne.
It's so... Moorish, that champagne.
It's Moorish is right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Very plush and
put it on ice for the big occasion.
I'm just looking at
one.
I'm looking at your website here because I can't remember what I paid for it, but it's you have it as a special at the moment. It's usually $92. The
80 or 82.
You've got it down to.
Got it really
you're
cheap.
Giving it away.
Yeah. So that's part of that champagne. We've got a big champagne promo going on at the moment. So
that's the Grand Reserve one that we had.
They do a rosé as well, which is really fantastic. We just don't really have any in stock, but we'll probably get more before the end of the year.
And the rosé event, as we said, at Prince Wine Store, November 23. I would get there. So we've got the Jules Mediterranean rosé.
Best value.
$20. Unbelievable. And
Chateau de Rouet from Provence is, you said, 40.
About, I think it's 45.
45. And then just slightly off topic, but the André Clouet Grand Reserve Brut.
$72
cheap. Down from $92.
Oh, that is cheap.
That is Prince Wine's.
Are you taking
straw.
A pay cut this week, is it?
I must be.
And that was Miles Thompson, bringing Melburnians the greatest wines in the world, princewinestore.com.au. Thank you, Miles.
Thank you, Miles.
Powered by Snowy Hydro, a leader in renewable energy. Switch to Aussie-owned Red Energy today. BSF. Book, screen, food.
Corrie, I am going to kick us off with a book because you've done all the heavy lifting with food this week and I'm looking forward to our little cocktail recipe. I have gone into my back catalogue. I've got to admit, a friend of mine said to me the other day, do you really read as many books as... And I'll be honest, I haven't actually finished my next book that I started after the Adrian Highland Canticle Creek. So I've gone into my back catalogue and I want to talk about an Australian classic by one of our favourite authors, Richard Flanagan. Now, everybody knows that Richard Flanagan won the Booker Prize for The Narrow Road to the Deep North, but I reckon this is his classic. And I love The Narrow Road to the Deep North, but Wanting is a book that we did in our book club. I think my friend Mindy Williams might have almost given me this one, our friend Mindy. Corrie, this is a beautiful book. It is, I don't know if you ever read Gould's Book of Fish, which was one of Richard Flanagan's first big hits, first big international bestsellers. But the artist Gould actually did a famous painting of an Indigenous leader, which is in the and Gould is actually a separate book, but that is a spin-off into Wanting. He gave birth to a girl called Mary, who was renamed and adopted by the governor, Australian governor at the time of Tasmania, Governor Franklin, who has had many books written about him and his wife. And it is the story of this girl. It is the story of the Aboriginal slaughter that systematically took place in Tasmania between the 1830s and the 1850s. And it is also the story of Charles Dickens, who put on a play about Governor Franklin, who, of course, disappeared in an expedition to the South Pole. So this sounds like there's a lot of different stories involved here, and I know it sounds complicated, but it's not. Wanting is basically wanting on several in several different themes. And Charles Dickens, at the time of this book, that the novel is set, was having an affair with a much younger actress with whom he was performing in a play, which was the play about that doomed South Pole expedition. It's about, and Charles Dickens, I think, had the famous quote, "We have in our lives only a few moments." And he's talking about a few moments of true happiness. And the link is obviously the South Pole expedition. So Governor Franklin's wife becomes obsessed with, first of all, finding her husband, and second of all, when I think realising that he's never going to return, making sure that he emerges as a hero from this expedition to the South. Her dream, her desire, her wanting, I guess, is to move back to London, move back to the UK from Australia, from Tasmania, with this Aboriginal girl. But she doesn't bring her home. She ends up leaving her behind. And young
Mathena.
That's right. She's Mary, but they change her name to Mathena. Young Mathena turns to prostitution. She becomes an alcoholic and meets a very, very tragic end. A very, very tragic end. It is this woven story through what it was like being Charles Dickens in London in the 1850s and his life with his wife, his life with this famous young Ethel, I think her name was, who, and there have been many books written about her too. What it was like to be him, who was a very popular writer, and of course he wrote in his periodical about this South Pole expedition, but I think it was James or John Wilkie who he co-wrote the play with, that though he was performing it with this young actress and has the affair, that becomes a fascinating by story. And I think it what Richard Flanagan does is he intertwines Tasmania and life in colonial Australia and life in England at that time so brilliantly. And it's almost a global story. And you think they're worlds apart, but they're not. Australia's ties to England at that time were so strong, and obviously with the governor. And what Australians, new Australians, the English were doing with Indigenous people, which was basically a mass slaughter, particularly in Tasmania, is just one of the most tragic stories. And yet it's a beautiful story that is heartbreaking. I think it's an absolute classic. I think it's better than The Narrow Road to the Deep North, even though I love that as well. And I would highly, highly recommend it. I've never read The Sound of One Hand Clapping, but that is also in my library at home. So I'm going to get onto that one next.
Well, it's quite topical that you mention Wanting, and I'm with you, Caro. It's my favourite Richard Flanagan book as well. I think that the ties between what happens to Mathena, who's abandoned by this wealthy woman, put in an orphanage, and she's then straddling two worlds. She's no longer welcome in her own First Nations community, but she's not welcome in the white community either. It's just a tragedy that
she
played
was
out
just
again
a
and
cruel
again.
Cruel experiment.
Again. It was awful. It was so awful. She was just dumped. But also, what's happening in Dickens' England at the same time? So many women and children found themselves in the same position, that they were just abandoned. They were used as slaves. They were sent down coal mines into factories, and they had lives of just misery. So it's a powerful, powerful book. But I'm glad you mentioned it this week, because Richard Flanagan has a new book out, a new novel. It's called, and it comes out this week, It's called Question 7. I haven't read it yet. Question 7. So question and then 7, the number, not the word, if you're trying to Google it and find out where you can buy it from your nearest bookshop. But it's an incredible story, I've been told. It's a fictional work, but it's based on the story of Richard Flanagan's father, who we know from The Narrow Road to the Deep North was an inspiration for that book because he spent time as a prisoner of war with the Japanese. But this character is a slave labourer near Hiroshima when the atomic bomb is dropped by the Americans. And there's a whole sort of connection there as well with I think it's H.G. Wells who was there at the time. And the book sounds multi-stranded again. It sounds fascinating. And that book comes out, Question 7 comes out this week. So it's a big week on the pod for Richard Flanagan.
I should just interrupt and say it was Governor Franklin, John Franklin, was actually an Arctic explorer, not Antarctic. Poles wrong. So he was trying to find the Northwest Passage. And, you know, it's been described, the competition that went on in the 1800s in terms of Arctic exploration has been compared to the space wars of the, you know, 1950s and 60s, which it really interesting how competitive it really was. But this sort of killing field of Tasmania from the early 1800s.
Have you watched Australian Wars yet? Rachel Perkins' amazing documentary?
No, I haven't.
Can I recommend that you do?
And the Indigenous leader who was painted by Gould is Tautara. He was Mary's father, and Sir John Franklin and Jane, of course, took her on. And after he, along with many others, they were all taken away and led to an island. They all went and lived on some island.
One of the Furneaux Islands, and that's the third part of
Flinders Island.
That's the third part of Jock Sarong's trilogy, which came out last year.
And so by 1860, only 15 of the imprisoned tribal people were left alive, and they were all dead by 1876. But young Mary, renamed Mathena, it sort of starts off as a really beautiful story, but it just ends absolutely
awful.
Tragically.
Misplaced goodwill, goodwillism.
Now, we've both been onto screen, and I know I'm a bit late to the party with the David Beckham documentary, but we were both fascinated by it, both absolutely loved it, and everybody's talking about it still, aren't they?
Oh, totally. I don't even know whether it was three or four parts because we just binged
four
on Netflix.
Directed by Fisher Stevens, who appeared in Succession.
It's so interesting. I think Australian viewers, Caro, probably are viewing this differently to viewers in the UK and indeed viewers in the US where, in the UK, Victoria and David Beckham have kept Hello magazine in circulation, I think, and now their children probably. And, of course, in the US it's a bit different but nonetheless as intense, I think, their star value because Beckham played with LA Galaxy in the early 2000s and now, of course, in current day, he's the president and co-owner of Inter Miami, which is the new soccer club where pink seems to be the key colour, which I kind of like.
Who this year signed Lionel Messi.
Yeah, that's right. But there's nostalgia galore in this for those of us who grew up with or have aged with the Beckhams. I certainly remember when the Spice Girls came onto the scene because my oldest daughter was a Spice Girl fan. What was she? Probably 10, 12 years of age. Can't remember. Maybe a bit younger. And David Beckham, because I've always loved on the periphery watching the English soccer league. We all knew about David Beckham. And then, of course, that wonderful one of the first movies that Keira Knightley was in, Bend It Like Beckham. We all knew about the bending. And I just think that it was just nostalgic. It was interesting. The achievements of David Beckham. He won the Premier League title 6 times with Man United, the FA Cup twice, the European Championships. He played with Real Madrid. They had huge success. It's quite extraordinary. His career started in the early 1990s and ended in May 2013. So a pretty significant career. But also it's Brand Beckham that I was most interested in. How from a very early age he moulded a brand around himself and then, of course, with Victoria. And there's just something about David Beckham. He has the it factor. There is no doubt in my mind that he is a natural gravitator to style, image, fashion, popular culture. He wears a suit and that suit manufacturer, Versace, it'll go off. He wears, yep. He shaves his head, everybody starts shaving his head. Even the other day, he was going to work in Miami. He was going to the club and he just had on a suit and a pair of trainers. And everybody suddenly wants to copy that. And Victoria Beckham, Posh Spice, has had a similar influence on fashion too. But the two of them have just really been so aware over this 30-year period of how to build their brand. And I think now a couple of their children are doing the same thing. It's most interesting. But at its heart, this documentary is a family story.
Yeah,
a family story with a lot of money and a lot of hired help.
The biggest takeout for me is that both David and Victoria come across as really nice people. Good people, obviously made some poor decisions along the way. You know, they were far too young. I mean, it's still, you know, should Victoria have told David about the fact that she was expecting their first child on the night before
England lost the
such
World
a
Cup.
Mess when he was famously red carded and became the scourge of the country. I think that was 1998. I remember that so clearly. There were things that I'd forgotten. Look, you know, when he was punted by Manchester United and the relationship that he had with Sir Alex Ferguson, who was a father figure to him for so many years, that was incredibly emotional.
But also his father, the interviews with his father and mother were so interesting. From an early age, his dad wanted David to play for Man United.
The ambition of the father.
Unbelievable.
The ambition of the father and the mother saying, you know, when he was so homesick when he had to move away at 14, 15 and she wanted to go and visit the father, said, nope. And when he had to bear dreadful things happening to him later, like when he wasn't allowed to play with Madrid, Real Madrid, while they were training because they knew he was going over to LA, and his treatment by the coach, the thing he said that got him through, the tough training was because of what his father had done to him as a kid. There was stuff left out. I mean, did you realise in the documentary that the parents had actually split up some years ago?
I Googled and found that out afterwards, Caro. I wondered why they were never in the same room together.
Yeah.
And I wondered why the mother never spoke fondly with warmth about the father and the father never mentioned the mother. So I thought something was afoot there.
Yes.
Because you think you might say in a documentary about your son, oh, yes, my wife did a great job rearing him, or she might have said it about him, or there was no joy there. So
that was left out. And look, some would say they covered it. They definitely glossed over his extramarital affairs. And obviously Rebecca Lewes was never mentioned, the nanny with whom he had an affair.
One of a couple of people he had an affair with.
I don't know if he's ever actually admitted to that. But although they addressed difficult times in their marriage and they showed the headlines, he said, I was lonely when I was in Madrid. They never actually addressed that. Rebecca Lewes has put something out, I think, on Instagram. She's living in Scandinavia now, married with kids. That was interesting. They didn't cover his relationship with Qatar when he became an ambassador for Qatar and earned quite a lot of money when the World Cup was there and was seen as being part of a bit of a sports washing situation. He's always denied that social media expletive-laden rant when he missed out on an MBE. He's always denied that that was him. He got an OBE, but he never got an MBE. Remember the signs of him queuing up to honour the Queen last year? Mm. And there were other ones that, I mean, it was interesting. They never really addressed the birth of the daughter, which obviously came after a lot of the stuff with the soccer career. And then when he dudded LA and went over to play for AC Milan to get back into the England team. But then I think he must have got injured because it never actually explained why he didn't play for England in that particular World Cup campaign. I think an injury happened that was sort of left out as well. So there were things that were left out. And interestingly, the probably the sports washing thing, and Fisher Stevens has addressed that and said, look, if we'd done an extra episode, it would have been in there. But I just love this stuff. I think they've got their places in the Cotswolds, isn't it?
I love it. Islands in the Stream.
Oh, that was, and the cupboards. We talked about the kitchen and the cupboards last week. He's absolutely fastidious.
And the fact that he puts out all his clothes on a hanger in his dressing room, the week's dressing. So he has all of the suits, all of the T-shirts, all of the socks, everything is there. He's quite highly organised. But the home life was really interesting because you're right, they do seem like nice people. When people say, oh, you know, Posh and Becks have no brains, which we've heard over the years, I don't agree with that. I think they've been incredibly smart with their brand Beckham, and they have really, both of them, redefined the modern celebrity. Like you think, you've got to go back to the 1990s to remember it was pre-Instagram and pre-using mobile phones to pass on data and information, and they were everywhere on every front page of everything. And they continued, and they have continued in different new digital media formats to be top. Like the Sun's wedding to that beautiful girl. What's the name of the Sun? Can't remember. I was going to say Brooklyn, but I don't think that's right. Is it Brooklyn? Looking at Courtney. Yes.
Brooklyn and well, it's Brooklyn and or Romeo.
There are four of them. Yeah, Romeo. But Brooklyn's the oldest one. But he's the one who's married this beautiful girl, and their wedding. Major event of the millennium. Mm.
Was there an issue because she didn't wear a Victoria Beckham? I can't remember, but yeah, whatever.
Well, we've read about it at the hairdresser or on our phones, but it's really interesting. In fact, that's interesting because they've gone from being hairdresser fodder to now on our phones. We wake up in the morning and if you follow Victoria Beckham's beautiful fashion line, as I do, and it is beautiful, her clothing is gorgeous, wouldn't fit me, but looks great, suddenly there'll be something on the feed about them. So they've really managed to do that, but yet at their heart, they're a very close family. They seem to have good connections with their children. Their home in the country is beautiful. It starts off somewhat, it's disbelieving at the beginning, the very opening scene to see David Beckham tending his beehives.
Yeah, with the honey.
You just think, oh, for God's sake, you know, he's got a staff of 30 who have probably set up those beautiful hives in that beautiful part of the garden. But in fact, by the end of the four episodes, you think he's quite a sincere person who had a gift. And the other telltale sign on that, Caro, to back that up, is how much, and I know it's edited, and I know they had control over the editorial, but it does seem genuine, the love and the respect that his teammates on all teams have had for him over the years.
Yeah,
that speaks volumes to me.
I would have liked more of the English Premier League, some of his opponents, describing what it was like to play on him with that amazing style. And their love affair, as you say, I mean, he is absolutely besotted by her. And you look back to some of the mistakes they did make. Well, you know, they were so young. And so, you know, they were navigating uncharted waters, I should say. But, the Alex Ferguson relationship.
Yeah, well, he was
coach
great.
And that
to
is,
get him to talk is big. He doesn't do a lot of interviews, Sir Alex Ferguson.
Addressing the shoe in the face. I mean, I remember that too. When he's saying there weren't stitches, David Beckham appeared with the scar over the eye. Really. Look, if you haven't seen it, watch it. There's a Spice Girls one coming out soon, which will be really interesting
interesting.
So that was our screen for the week, Corrie. Food, thanks to Cobram Estate, the wonderful Cobram Estate olive oil, is going to come via a recipe from you today.
You know this recipe, Caro. I'm just going to hold up my phone with the photograph. That will remind you of what you and I were served recently by our friend Nikki, who was in charge of bar snacks, and her bar snack brought the house down. So this is like a 2023 communal version of the old fondue, the Swiss fondue.
Because there's a lot of dipping.
There's a lot of dipping, a lot of sharing, and we all stood around the counter in my kitchen dipping and munching and complimenting. So this is called caviar potato chips and lemon cream. Potties, if you're looking for a summer bar snack, look no further. This is what's involved. 1/4 cup of creme fraiche or sour cream, 3/4 teaspoon of finely grated lemon zest, 4 ounces of salmon roe or other caviar, and potato chips. I would suggest plain potato chips. No flavours, just plain potato chips.
But something that's up to sort you. Of quality like Copper Kettle or...
Yeah, a good potato chip. So there's a bit of money being spent on your potato chip and your salmon roe. But after that, the time that you will save in the kitchen, because essentially your guests are doing all the work, I can tell you that this is a winner. So do not prepare this in advance because your potato chips will go limp and soggy. And just get the guests to do it. Just line it all up in your most beautiful little bowls and they'll all think this is fantastic and they'll stand around with their spoons and do this. So just to prepare, in a small bowl you whisk together the creme fraiche and the lemon zest. And what everybody does is they get their potato chip, they put a little dollop of creme fraiche on the chip, and then they top it with a spoonful of caviar. One munch and you're in heaven.
Pop. Pow.
Pop. So many layers. Oh, you would have thought we were all at a wine tasting with Miles, the way we're like, there are so many layers. Like suddenly it's a fishy and then there's a salty and then there's a lemony. And we were talking, obsessed.
And the crunch. The crunch is always the secret, isn't it?
With a good recipe. The crunch is the secret. That is it. It is easy. Courtney Jane will put a photograph of these aforementioned little tiny, beautiful potato chip. I don't know. They're just treasures, really. That will be on our show notes. But just remember, everybody, don't pre-prepare. Just have everything there for everybody to do, and you will be the hit of the summer barbecue.
That was Corrie's recipe, caviar potato chips and lemon cream, basically creme fraiche with lemon rind, lemon zest.
And Nikki tells us that this recipe first appeared via Gwyneth Paltrow's Goop. And the Goop recipe has a recipe, how to make your own potato chips. We just went straight to the New York Times food section, buy your own potato chips.
I had some great homemade potato chips the other day that aren't really potato chips. They're just crisps made by Willie Ziggier, who was on the podcast recently with Deb Conway. He uses just mountain bread. Cooked in a very hot oven with, you know, brushed with probably Cobram Estate extra virgin olive oil, the beautiful locally grown extra virgin olive oil.
Is there no end to that Mr. Cobram's talents, really?
And some spices
He's
and
popped
salt.
Up in puddings and cakes and
Absolutely
potato chips.
Absolutely delicious.
So you're grumpy, Cara, so tell us what you're grumpy about.
Very quickly, Corrie, yet again Qantas. How on earth?
Do you have a thing about Qantas like I have a thing about roadworks?
Oh, well, I mean, I don't think I'm alone. I don't think I'm Robinson Crusoe in my quest against Qantas at the moment. As we know, they're appearing at the moment before the Senate inquiry. There's issues with Qatar Airways. I won't go into that. But how on earth can Qantas even attempt to justify? I mean, Alan Joyce just having left the country and refusing to ever come back is just an utter disgrace.
Where's he gone?
Ireland. To visit his mum, who's not well, apparently, but I don't think he has any intention of appearing before the inquiry, having taken that extraordinary multi-million-dollar bonus. They are attempting to justify, and not just putting their hand up and apologising, for booking passengers on ghost flights. Mm. So as we know, I mean, you can't overstate this enough. Qantas cancelled flights, or new flights were going to be cancelled them weeks out, but continued to book passengers on those flights. Now, I don't care what clerical misdemeanour happened or how on earth there was some technical issue that forced them to do that. But in the end, that is outrageous, it's fraudulent, and they should just apologise. But no, they've gone before the Senate inquiry and they're saying, now, look, there's a reason for this and blah, 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 blah. I'm not even going to go into it. Sometimes, Corrie, you've just got to put your hand up.
Yeah, and we can all vote with our feet, Caro. We're all going to use a different carrier. End of story. I refuse to use Qantas.
You know, sometimes it's difficult.
Well.
But you're right.
It actually is difficult sometimes.
If it comes down to choice, I will always go with Virgin now. Mm. Absolutely always. Because they're just more reliable. Now, Corrie, six quick questions for Red Energy. You can kick us off.
Caro, what's the best new song you've heard this week?
You will love this song. And I hope they release it as a single. As I told you recently, I went and saw Mark Seymour on Sunday, formerly of the Hunters and Collectors. Now, I think the Undertones. I think that's the right name of the band. Brilliant band, unbelievable performer. He was so good on grand final day when he sang Holy Grail at halftime at the MCG. But he has written a song, co-written a song with Linda Bull, and it's called Waiting for the Kid. He performed it at the Memo Hall in St Kilda, the old RSL Hall off Ackland Street in St Kilda on Sunday. He's doing a lot of live shows at the moment. This is a beautiful song, Waiting for the Kid. I think it was an idea that emanated from Linda Bull of the famous Bull Sisters, Linda and Vicar, about picking up her child from school, her daughter, I think, from school in the rain. And they wrote this song together. It is just a beautiful ballad. She came on stage and performed it with Mark Seymour, who has written another brilliant song about the Westgate Bridge that I hadn't heard before. And obviously a lot of the famous ones like Throw Your Arms Around Me and You Don't Make Me Feel Like a Woman Anymore. Waiting for the Kid is an absolute cracker. Corrie, what's the best new version of an old song you've heard this week?
Well, talk about late to the party. Gosh, I'm a decade late to the party. But I heard, driving back down to the beach the other day, I had been ODing a bit on podcasts related to what's happening in Gaza at the moment, and I just needed to just chill out from that. And I came across Angus and Julia Stone's Stay With Me. This was recorded, I think, in about 2015 or 2016. It was the song that was written by Tom Petty and Sam Smith and was sung by Sam Smith and became a really big hit. But Angus and Julia Stone do this beautiful acoustic version, as they often did. And this is it.
Darling, stay with me.
Caro, what was the best garden you saw last week?
Rose Craddock in Caulfield North, a famous old Australian house. It used to be on acres and acres and acres. It was built in 1857. It is just one of the most beautiful houses in Melbourne, and it was part of the National Gallery Women's Association, NGVWA Association's, Open Garden Day, which we talked about on the podcast a few weeks ago.
I heard it was a smashing success.
Well, it was raining early in the morning. We were all a bit worried whether people would come, but they did in their droves. And there were some fascinating gardens, mainly around the Caulfield North St Kilda area. But it predates that sort of Victorian Italianate style of Lambassa, another famous Caulfield house, which was sort of a bit later, I think 1870s. It is just, the Langdon family, of course, had it for many, many, many years, over two centuries. It's just absolutely stunning. And the garden, just some great ideas, a beautiful tennis court.
It can't be over two centuries.
Well, the family had it from over the 1800s and the
1900s. I see what you mean. It was spanning too. Sorry, I was going to say, gosh, it was built in the...
If you're wandering around Caulfield North, you can see how beautiful the house is from the street. And obviously there is not nearly so much land anymore. But some great ideas, fruit trees in massive pots, which I'm trying to achieve in not such massive grand style. But with a sort of climbing, I think they're called, I don't know the name of the gardenia, maybe rock gardenia, around the pots as a sort of ground cover, or chef's rosemary or whatever that crawling rosemary is called, with the fruit trees. Just absolutely beautiful. A couple of amazing old date palms and just an absolutely stunning garden. Can highly recommend it, Corrie, and I think it does open at other times of the year. Corrie, what is the latest bad behaviour you've seen from the Republican members of Congress?
Oh, where do you begin? You will notice, Caro, I've been rather quiet on American politics lately because it's just been too catastrophic for the future of democracy to talk about. But I became really angry on behalf of journalists the other day when the latest choice for Speaker, Republican Mike Johnson of Louisiana, was standing up there. He'd got the votes. He was the new speaker, surrounded by a whole lot of just odd Republican members, not traditionalists like Mitt Romney, but a whole lot of wackos. And Rachel Scott from ABC News asked the new speaker, Mike Johnson, about the fact that he voted against the election result back in 2021, in January 2021, which of course triggered off the march on the Capitol building. And as she put this forward to him, asking him about his support at that time, Virginia Fox, an 80-year-old white-haired grandmother from North Carolina,
And you can see this in the YouTube. She's standing right beside Johnson, preening, just the biggest smile on her face. And as soon as the reporter asks this question, she just looks at the reporter and says, "Shut up," and just continues to say, "Shut up, shut up." And next to Fox is the far-right Colorado representative, Lauren Bobbitt. And she made such a dismissive remark, a dismissive gesture, sorry.
As opposed to Lorena Bobbitt.
Yes, correct.
Gee.
I think it's Bobert might be how she pronounces it, I'm not sure. And then behind her, Elise Stefanik, who's the House caucus leader from New York, just was also making bad comments about the ABC reporter. I just thought it was terrible. And then somebody else called out, 2024, and then Johnson just smiles and doesn't say anything. This reporter, well, I would have assumed was completely humiliated, but was not, and then asked the next question, do you support additional aid to Ukraine? And at that stage, the old grandmother, Mrs. Fox, with the 80-year-old grandmother with the silver hair, says, you've asked your question, go away, go away. And this is a media conference. And surely the American voters have an opportunity and have a right via their journalists to hear what the new Speaker of Congress thinks about these issues. And was he in fact an election denier? But of course, the reporter was howled down by this mob of just weirdo wackos who are now in the Congress. Honestly, I don't know what is happening over there, Cara, but there is an election next year, so we should all be mindful and we should all be watching and all be aware.
It was like two different worlds, wasn't it? Watching Anthony Albanese's visit to Washington and the performances and the scenes with Joe Biden and what was going on in rather scene-stealing fashion and one of the events you've just talked about. It's a great
Unbelievable.
Concern.
Cara, what is the most on-trend outfit you spotted this week?
They're everywhere, Corrie. The silk pyjama patio look. So often floral, usually patterned, a lovely pair of silk pants, always flared, usually loose, with either a short sleeve or long sleeve matching top.
Were you wearing this yourself or did you spy it?
I wasn't, but I went to a lovely party on Friday night and they were everywhere, all very different. Usually there were some lovely outfits too, like suits, like patterned pants and blazers. But the silk pyjama for an evening spring or summer soiree seems to be, it helps if you're tall and willowy, which I am not, but they all looked absolutely
fabulous.
I'm not
laughing at you, I'm laughing at me. I would look like I was actually in my pyjamas, even if I put a pair of high heels on.
There's a fine line, but no, it works, I think.
Predominant colours?
Dusty blues and greens and dusty pinks and greys. No, beautiful colours, beautiful patterns, but not always bright. Usually more that sort of dusty sort of style. No, it's everywhere.
I'll be on the lookout.
If you see a pair, maybe you could, when you're launching next year's Writers' Festival at your soiree in January.
I'll do it in my pyjamas.
Well, no, they're not pyjamas. It's sort of that's the look.
Yes, but if everybody's wearing them, doesn't it make you want to do something different?
Not everybody, but there was about four people wearing them and they all look great. I'm going to call it the patio suit.
Okay. Note to my daughter, Francesca, who famously said a couple of months ago, just everybody's going to be wearing florals and colours. I'm just going to do neutrals this summer. I'm just going to do black and white. I went, okay, fine.
She's just
put on the WhatsApp, the 3 C's, Coco, Corrie and Checo. She's just put on, what about this dress? What do you think? And everything that she's put on is pink and orange and flowers. And
well, remember I told you about my tired-eyed number?
Yes.
And I wore it, guess what? Someone there a little bit younger than me and half the size of me was in the same dress. Different colour scheme, but yeah.
Did you do high fives or?
No, I did go. I didn't know her very well, but I went over and said who wore it better. And it was definitely her. But yeah, no.
Were you looking at for her to say to you, oh, you look great?
No, I was, you know, that, as a
oh, you were complimenting her.
Started,
oh, okay.
Yes. Anyway, that's my on-trend outfit this week. What is this week's amazing fact?
Pickleball. Have you heard of pickleball?
I've heard of pickleback.
Pickleball. Pickleball is America's fastest growing sport. Oh, and you call yourself a sports reporter.
Oh, mine's a cocktail. I don't know what pickleball is, but you're going to tell me, I think. It's not a cocktail.
Miles, it's a game invented in the 1960s by a couple of dads who were holidaying on, it was 1965, and they were holidaying together on Bainbridge Island, just in Washington State there, and they returned from a five-hour golf game to find one of the kids sulking, a 13-year-old son of one of the boys, saying, "You don't play with me. You've been gone for hours. There's nothing to do here. I'm bored. I'm bored." So the dads decided to invent a game using the backyard badminton court, a couple of ping pong paddles, and a perforated plastic ball from one of the dads' baseball practice sets. And pickleball was born. A neighbour came in on it and said, "Look, I'm not sure that those ping pong paddles are working," and built, actually carved during the holiday, two larger paddles. So smaller than a tennis racket, but bigger than a ping pong paddle. And away it went. So, Caro, this is a remarkable story. The reason pickleball, I mean, I think there are lots of reasons why pickleball has become such a popular thing, and it's now coming to Australia, a bit on that in a minute. But it uses less land than a tennis court. It appeals to older folk who may now find the three sets of competitive tennis a bit beyond them. In the US, pickleball is a game for people of all ages, but only 32% of picklers, as they're known, are under the age of 60, right? And then the other part of it is it's fun and fast, and the idea is to keep the ball in play rather than, you know, in tennis you try and catch your opponent off guard. For example, the first serve, you're trying to actually serve an ace, right?
Yeah.
So this idea is you can't, yeah, that's right. So this is all about kind of trying to keep the ball in play. So you can have these long rallies. How it got its name, the game was, as we know, scrapped together on this holiday. And one of the wives of the gentleman reflected that it had all come together in a piecemeal way, a bit of badminton, a bit of tennis. These rules were all kind of being thrown around. And she reflected on her college rowing days. And at college rowing regattas, those who'd been rejected from the main race and the big boat, they rowed in things called pickle boats, which is like the second tier. So she called
like
it
a repercharge,
but something like that. doesn't have quite that. Like repercharge ball doesn't have to say, but she dubbed it pickleball. And although there is a fallacy out there that this same family, they owned a spoodle of some sort, and they called it pickles, and that's why they named. But that is not true.
Were spoodles even around in 1965?
Good question. 2 years ago, 4,000 Aussies were playing pickleball. Now, between 12,000 and 15,000 people are playing it. There are 70 pickleball clubs and associations, Caro, in Australia. In the US, the game is growing at such a speedy rate and starting to make money. Nick Kyrgios and Naomi Osaka are now part owners of a pickleball club in Miami.
That is extraordinary.
Kim Cloisters and LeBron James have invested in the major league. There's a league. So it's a paddle and a ball sport, played on court dimensions. There's a thing called the kitchen, which is a bit hard to explain, but immediately either side of the net, there is it's a metre, I guess, maybe a metre wide. There's an area where you cannot hit on the full, because the fathers realised that everybody was just doing these volleys right at the net, and that was making it too easy because the ball would go out of play. So you're not allowed to hit within that particular area. It's known as the kitchen. It's complicated. I've watched a couple of YouTubes thinking, maybe not for me, but a friend of mine at yoga, one of my yoga buddies, said that she was off to play pickleball.
You have told me about something I have never heard
of. Well, looking at your face, I can tell that you have never
heard. I have never heard of pickleball, and now I know. That is amazing. That's an amazing
fact.
That's
why it's called an amazing fact, Sish.
It's a really amazing fact. Well done, Corrie. Good
research. You thought it was a cocktail.
It sounds more enjoyable.
Your head's back in the cocktail cabinet.
That was six quick questions for Red Energy, powered by Australian, 100% Australian electricity and gas, powered, I should say, by Snowy Hydro, a leader in renewable energy. Switch to Aussie-owned Red Energy today. Corrie, great chat. Lovely seeing you. And what do we say?
Don't shoot the pickleball.
Thank you.
thanks for listening to this episode of Don't Shoot the Messenger with Caroline Wilson and Corrie Perkin. We love hearing from you, so join us on Facebook or Instagram at Don't Shoot Pod, or email us via feedback@don'tshootpod.com.au. And if you'd like to support the show, the best way to do it is to tell a friend to listen. Your word of mouth recommendations are just so greatly appreciated. And of course, you can support our wonderful sponsors who make the podcast possible. Red Energy, awarded Canstar's most trusted energy providers 3 times. Maybe it's time you switch to Red. Cobram Estate, Australia's most awarded extra virgin olive oil, grown, harvested and first cold pressed in Northern Victoria. And Prince Wine Store, Bank Street, South Melbourne, and delivering Australia-wide. Visit princewinestore.com.au.